University of California Television presents this podcast of Jeff Greenfield, Ethics and Politics in the Mass Media Age. This program was recorded at UC Santa Barbara on October 2, 2005, and is part of the Walter H. Capps Center series. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
It's my pleasure to have all of you here for this first event of this calendar, or for this academic year season. It's also a pleasure for me to announce that this is the inaugural lecture of a particular new initiative of the CAPS Center, and that initiative is called the CAPS Forum on Ethics. We're particularly interested in ethics. As you know, that's in the title of our center, the Walter H. Capps Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life. But we're really particularly interested in the major kinds of ethical dilemmas that face us today. I think there's a yearning for clarity in a kind of zone of openness and more authenticity than often we're able to have under contemporary living conditions today. So what we're trying to do is to create an environment where we can discuss ethical issues with hopefully in a more authentic way. So this is our inaugural lecture in the CAPS Forum on Ethics. And these events will usually be held here on campus, although most of our events are held downtown, usually at Victoria Theater. But these events are held on campus because we're trying to bring in students into these conversations. And in fact, for each of our events, and we'll have one CAPS Forum on Ethics lecture per quarter, three a year, and each of those is coordinated with a number of classes here on campus, so we hope in time to build a greater student clientele and extend this discussion right into the classroom. We have scheduled for later in this year, you might be interested in knowing, we will have Peter Steinfels speaking, columnist for the New York Times, later, I think next in the spring. We also have Wangari Maathai, the 2004 Nobel Peace Laureate, speaking on women and the environment. So we have some programs that I hope you'll be on the look for. If you're not on our CAPS Center email list, we'd be delighted to put you on that list. And if you can speak to someone out front, I'm sure, well, not just anyone, but speak to somebody. Speak to somebody that might be able to get. We have a number of people helping with the arrangements here. If you see one of those folks, if not, see me, give me your email address, and we'll make sure you know about our events. So that's out in the future. And we hope that you will make note of those and do plan to attend. This afternoon, we're truly privileged to have Jeff Greenfield speak to us. Jeff Greenfield is CNN's senior political analyst and a contributor to CNN's Inside Politics, American Morning, Paula's On Now, and Newsnight with Aaron Brown. He's been at the forefront of providing his in-depth insight and analysis on the inner workings of the 2004 political campaigns, including coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Boston, the Republican National Convention in New York, and the presidential and vice presidential debates. Previously, he was host of CNN's Greenfield at Large, a multi-forum program dedicated to the most relevant issues of the day. Previously, he, along with CNN's Judy Woodruff, Bernard Shaw, and political analyst Bill Snyder, hosted the network's nightly special election program during the 37 days as the presidential election story and the Florida recount unfolded. From this experience, he also penned, Oh Waiter, One Order of Crow, published by Putnam, chronicling the events of election night 2000 and beyond. Since joining the network in January 1998, he has reported on and provided analysis for a wealth of stories ranging from the impeachment and trial of President Bill Clinton to the public reaction to the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. He has also been a guest or guest host for Larry King Live and moderated CNN's town hall meetings, such as Listening After Littleton and Investigating the President Media Madness. Greenfield reported live for CNN from the 2000 Republican and Democratic conventions and served as a panelist in the WCBS New York Senate debate between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Representative Rick Lazio. In addition to his work on television, he writes a column for Time Magazine. He has contributed articles to the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, and National Lampoon, and has authored or co-authored 9 books, including Television, The First 50 Years, and The Real Campaign. His first novel, The People's Choice, was published in 1995 and was named one of the New York Times Notable Books of the Year. Director Penny Marshall has purchased the motion picture rights to this political satire. He's garnered a number of awards, including the 2002 Quill Award for Professional Achievement, 3 Emmy Awards for his contributions to Nightline South Africa specials in 1985 and in 1990, and for a 1992 primetime special on Ross Perot. He has a bachelor's degree with honors from the University of Wisconsin and graduated with honors from Yale Law School with a Bachelor of Legal Letters degree. This afternoon, he'll speak to us with the title, The Best of Times, The Worst of Times, Ethics and Politics in the Mass Media Age. Please welcome Jeff Greenfield.
Afternoon, let me first express my gratitude to the Cap Center for scheduling this event after all the key baseball games were ended. This is one of the great advantages about living on the West Coast is you can get up, have a cup of coffee on Sunday, and they're playing baseball on television. And by the way, if you want to win some money on a long shot bet, try Houston. You heard it here first. Short series, pitching matters, Pettit and Clements. Any questions? Okay. On a somewhat more serious note, I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm honored to be here, not just because this series honors a remarkable teacher and public figure, but because I owe Walter Capps a debt of gratitude and a kind of apology, because I met him under false pretenses, more or less. In 1996, I had determined to take a leave from ABC News and to spend the winter working on a book and just taking some time off. And my one non-negotiable demand was that it had to be someplace where the weather was really nice. And a dear friend suggested Santa Barbara. I knew nothing of the community, having not watched the soap opera. but I was determined to check it out, and I followed the absolute first rule of any journalist, which is, never pay for anything you can get somebody else to pay for. Speaking of ethics. As it turned out, there was a very significant congressional race out here, kind of emblematic. Andrea C. Strand, a first-term congresswoman, a protege of Newt Gingrich, in a rematch with Walter Capps, an ardent liberal. You couldn't get two more disparate candidates. So I came out and did a piece. Found an affordable rental on Padero Lane, roughly the size of a garage, which was fine. Fell in love with Santa Barbara, fell in love with the woman who is now my wife, and we still keep a more or less affordable place here, roughly the size of a garage, not on Padero Lane. So there's a special place in my heart for Walter Capps for that reason alone, but there is more to it than that. Because when I interviewed him for Nightline, I asked him an obvious question, which is something, as you'll find out, that I specialize in. And I said, look, you have this fantastic job at a great public university. You're a revered teacher. You have this great house. He'd lived here from the time when academics could actually afford to buy a nice house in Santa Barbara, which gives you some sense of his tenure. But if you win, you're going to be a 60-plus-year-old freshman congressman in what is likely to be the minority. Why do you want to do this? And his answer was striking. He said, I want to see how the ideas of the founding fathers about government and about politics, how they play out in real life, you know, how relevant those notions are to the way we actually do government. And I remember thinking this was going to be a basis for one heck of a real-life movie, you know, Mr. Capps Goes to Washington. Now, regrettably, of course, the one gift that this remarkably gifted man was not given was time. And so we never had a chance to really know how he felt about the relentless fundraising, the influence peddling, whether that would have driven him back to Santa Barbara after a year. Would he have found a like-minded community of men and women, even in the hothouse that is Washington, who were really looking toward bigger things and really wrestling with hard questions about public policy? I do not know the answer to these questions. But I do know the place that Walter Capps was starting from is exactly the right place to begin this inquiry. What kind of system did the men who shaped the Constitution, and they were of the same race and the same gender and almost wholly of one class, but what did they mean to create? What did they think was required as a matter of ethical behavior from public figures and from the press and from the citizenry? That's an important part that I'm going to get to. How do we stack up today? And are the failings of our time matters of ethics, or are they matters of much more fundamental and structural changes in how we govern ourselves and how we communicate? We know what the folks who created the system thought about the free flow of information. They thought that robust debate, opinion, exchanges was absolutely essential to this whole new idea of a freely governing people. And the quotes are familiar to you, perhaps, but they bear repeating. John Adams said, liberty cannot be preserved without a general knowledge of the people. A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it, said James Madison, is but the prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both. And in a line that is used at every journalism convention that I've ever been at, Thomas Jefferson famously said, were it left for me to choose between government without newspapers and newspapers without government, I would unhesitatingly choose the latter. But if that suggests that the framers envisioned a public discourse of sweet reason and civic gentility, this is profoundly misleading. They not only knew that politics was a contact sport, but they practiced it with absolute and unfettered enthusiasm. Newspapers were almost entirely financed and published by political factions. They produced a steady stream of invective about their opponents that would make a modern cable TV talk fest mouth blush with shame. It ought to be noted that many years before anyone ever heard the name Monica Lewinsky, Alexander Hamilton, when accused of stealing money from the Treasury and sending money to a no-goodnik as part of a financial scheme, in his own defense, wrote a monograph and said, no, I was sleeping with the man's wife and paying him off because he was blackmailing me. I should tell you, none of what I'm about to tell you I am making up. And the idea that policy differences should not be personalized would have been treated as breathtakingly naive by the people who today are on our stamps and our money and, in some cases, on Mount Rushmore. John Rutledge was a Supreme Court justice, a Federalist, was nominated to be Chief Justice by George Washington, had the temerity to criticize a treaty that the Washington administration had negotiated. And his own party accused him of literally insanity, because no sane person could possibly say what he had to say. And by the way, he was defeated for Chief Justice. Thomas Jefferson was called, among other things, an atheist, a Jacobin, and a moral leper who had sex with one of his slaves. I didn't say that everything they said was false, by the way. And when he ran for re-election in 1804, the president of Yale, that's a Eastern private university, he said that his return to office would mean that our wives and daughters would be the victims of legalized prostitution. So that quote from Jefferson about how much he loved newspapers, that was before he became president. late in his administration, he wrote to a friend, "Nothing can now be believed which is now seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put in that polluted vehicle." Now, I offer this brief look back to disabuse you of one of the perennial complaints about our political process is that we are in a steady descent from a far better time, that we have fallen from grace, that there was this period, this Edenic period when all was sweetness and light. You go back and choose any period you want. 1824, Andrew Jackson is accused of being a bigamist and a murderer. His people accuse his opponent, John Quincy Adams, of having pimped for the Tsar of Russia when Adams was an envoy there. Go back to the whole first two-thirds of the 20th century when in the South the surest way for a Southern politician to succeed was by inflaming the race issue. In one governor's race in, I believe, Alabama, operatives of one campaign hired a lookalike of another candidate to be driven through rural Alabama in the back of a car with cigar-smoking, well-dressed blacks to suggest that this man had committed the sin of associating with uppity colored people. 1928, Al Smith, the first Catholic to be nominated by a major party. His opponents have a picture of him in front of the Holland Tunnel, and they circulate broadsides throughout the Bible Belt claiming that this is the tunnel to the Vatican. Once again, none of this is made up. The McCarthy era, enough already. My point is you really have to look beyond the gnashing of teeth and the rending of garments that are as predictable as the return of the swallows to San Juan Capistrano, assuming they're still coming back, that accompanies every political campaign about how this is the worst campaign ever. And for me, this is an exercise in false memory. It's a notion, it's a myth of the pastoral, that sometime back then when tomatoes tasted better, politics was better too. This is captured for me perfectly in the movie Atlantic City, when a young hoodlum from the Midwest meets Burt Lancaster, an old hoodlum, and they're walking the boardwalk. It's the young man's first sight of the ocean, and he looks and he exclaims about the ocean, and Burt Lancaster says, "You should have seen the ocean in the old days." This is not, it seems to me, a way to talk about what's right and wrong with our politics. Nor is it necessarily true that politics has become ethically awful because the people that you root for lose. This is an important point. Now, I know this is a strictly nonpartisan, non-ideological center, but I just have a sneaking suspicion, call me madcap, that many of you in this audience are not entirely happy with the people now running things in Washington. Fine, okay, I'm glad you applauded then, because here's my point. It doesn't necessarily, because the people you like lose, doesn't mean that the people who've won necessarily have won by foul means. It's not proof that people don't listen to issues when they vote for people who don't agree with you on the issues. And by the way, every time, this is a nonpartisan point, because it's very hard for people to say, you know what, the voters listened to both sides of the issue and they went with the other guy. That's just not how we think. You know, in 96, after Clinton won, one of the neoconservatives wrote, well, he broke the fundraising laws, therefore it was a stolen election. There are people who still believe that John Kennedy was elected only because Richard Daley in Chicago stole votes. The reality is way more complicated. And, you know, I think there are probably still people in this audience who think that the last two elections, one way or another, were stolen. Okay. Or that the only reason people win is because they stoop to low, vicious, underhanded means. Sometimes that's true. All I'm saying is it's not necessarily proof. If the country has moved in a direction you don't like, there may be lots of reasons for it, but ethical misconduct may not be the key. My favorite concession speech in history was given by a well-known political prankster slash political guy named Dick Tuck, who after losing a race for the state Senate in Los Angeles, in his concession speech said, "The people have spoken, the bastards." And that's a useful thing to keep in mind, that in my view, you can't jump from the fact that somebody you really don't like has won and think it had to have been for horrible reasons. So I propose a somewhat different way of looking at it. Because I do think there are issues of genuine concern out there, and questions that I think are very much in the spirit of Walter Capps, who, as Dr. Roof noted, talked about engaging the public in conversations about the common good, about what was good for the country. So ask us a different set of questions. Do our politicians, left, right, middle, up, down, engage in serious political debate? Or do they just concoct talking points that sound good and are based on nothing but the hope that it will manipulate opinion? Our media outlets, do they provide real, intellectually honest, and rigorous analysis? And do voters even care? If our politics have grown less serious, why? How much of what we are seeing is a function of ethical malfeasance or nonfeasance, and how much a product of fundamental structural changes in how we are governed, how we live, where we live, how we work, and how we talk to each other? So look at the political terrain. Look at the discourse. And the reason, you know, it's a terrible cliche, the best of times, the worst of times, but in this case, it seemed to me resonant. In one sense, this is the best of times. A citizen who wants to follow or even participate in the discourse has tools at his or her disposal unimaginable a generation ago. Just thinking of television, which is an old medium at this point. If you go back 25 years, what do we have now that we didn't have then? Well, there was no Nightline, there was no NewsHour on PBS, there was no C-SPAN, where you can follow debates all. There was no C-SPAN 2, for those who find C-SPAN 1 too racy. There was no CNN, Fox, MSNBC, no Frontline on PBS, no History Channel, where World War II has now been going on far longer than the original government. No documentary networks, nothing like that. When you fold in the internet, then the problem is hardly scarcity of information, it's what do you do with this astonishing flow of information. Anyone with a computer and a website, and a web connection, rather, which is already most Americans, can access, literally at the flick of a finger, nonpartisan legislative analysis, opinion of ranging up and down the terrain, commentary, rants left, right, and center, blogs that go into incredible detail about the course of political debate. You can access political history, you can access philosophy, and even if you're worried about the so-called digital divide, people too poor to afford computers, they can do the same thing at the public library, most public libraries, which, while not convenient, is no more of a burden than some of us bore half a century ago when we had to go to the public library to read interesting books. So what's the problem? The problem is that more and more of us are choosing not to dip into this material. In fact, more and more Americans seem disconnected with the whole broad national conversation. And those of you who say, wait a second, what about the vote last year? I'm going to get to that. But start with young people, because it is the solemn obligation of all of us old people to proclaim the shortcomings of the next generation, or two or three next generations. Much of what I'm telling you has been researched from, or to be more accurate, stolen from, gathered by a guy named Dave Mindich, who's a former CNN producer and now teaches journalism. But the numbers are really quite striking. It's often been said that young people don't read papers as much as their elders, but as they get older, they pick up the habit. They start getting plugged in because they get jobs, they get families, they have mortgages, and they start to care. But guess what? This is now seen as less and less true. For one thing, this generation of the young is radically different. Even given the relative lack of interest of young people, in 1972, about half of young people, 18 to 20-year-olds, read a newspaper every day. Today, it's less than a quarter. Second, those who were young a few decades ago did indeed, were indeed thought of as people who will just get into this habit. But starting somewhere in the 70s or 80s, this stopped being true. Back in 72, three quarters of people 34 to 37 read a newspaper every day. Today, it's a third, which means that their kids are in turn much less likely to pick up the habit, because one of the ways you get into reading newspapers is you see your parents reading the newspaper and you pick up the habit. So, okay, well, they're getting the news from television, right? Uh-uh. So absent are young people from the habit of watching network news that the average age of the network news watcher in just a decade has gone from roughly 50 to roughly 60. And all you have to do to know this is to look at the ads that run during the evening news. To summarize this inelegantly, from head to toe, from virtually every orifice, something is wrong. Or to put it another way, the people watching TV news tend to be those about whom it can be said, everything that's supposed to be soft is getting hard, and everything that's supposed to be hard is getting soft. I will just leave it at that. But it tells you something about who's watching the news. All right, well, then you say, well, okay, they must be getting their information on the web and through the blogs and stuff. Well, in fact, the Pew Research Center and others have found that younger people indeed use the web a lot, but they don't use it for information. They use it for games, instant messaging, email, and other diversions, some of which are probably best left to the imagination. So what's happening to the next generation of citizens, and what has already happened to people now in the not-so-young generation, is they are losing more and more of a connection to this broader public conversation. Professor Mindich notes that in past times, the information gap, what do you know about the country? What do you know about history? The information gap between younger and older people was relatively small. In other words, during the Civil Rights and Watergate eras and before that, young people knew almost as much about what was going on as their elders. But now, while public knowledge has declined across the board, among young folks it is really dramatic. You ask them who the contenders are on Survivor or Big Brother or The Apprentice, they're going to know that. Ask them who's running for president, you might get some blank stares. And if you really want to be depressed, watch Jay Leno's Jaywalking, this episode where he takes a camera out and apparently ambulatory conscious Americans are utterly clueless about everything, and not only that, but are kind of proud to be on television showing that they don't know anything. This may also apply to some people in my business, but we're going to leave that for a while. Al Roker told me, just in a casual conversation a week ago, that he went out to kind of emulate what Leno does, and he would go to the streets of Manhattan and find, you know, well-dressed, apparently okay people, functioning people. And he asked them, for instance, how many states there are in the United States, and the answers would depress you. 50 was not the near unanimous answer. Now, you can take some comfort in the fact that, you know, 'twas ever thus. There's a front-page New York Times story showing that large numbers of college freshmen really couldn't say much about George Washington, Abe Lincoln, Jefferson, and that story was published on April 4th, 1943. But I do think that something's going on here, and I think this lack of connection to the broader conversation does threaten a lot of what the framers had in mind. And the question for us, I think, is, all right, what are some of the ethical implications of this? Look, some matters, it seems to me, are just too obvious to belabor. Political leaders shouldn't steal. They shouldn't lie. They shouldn't seek power by falsely defaming their opponents, and they shouldn't consider their opponents enemies. My favorite line from Bob Dole's 1996 acceptance speech was where he said to this partisan crowd, he stopped in the middle and talked about Clinton. He said, "I would remind you, Bill Clinton is my opponent, not my enemy." A lot of people in politics don't think that way. Journalists, we shouldn't lie. We shouldn't fabricate stories. We shouldn't publish defamatory accusations without being awfully sure that what we're publishing is true. But I don't think this gets you very far in what's happened to the national conversations. Let's try to turn this a little. Is there an ethical dimension to the fact that our politics today is polarized in a particular way? That in the interest of preserving their jobs, Republicans and Democrats have drawn lines in their state and national legislatures such that it is almost impossible to have a competitive campaign. 90% of House incumbents win by landslide or near landslide margins. And one of the reasons why, in fact, today people think that the current troubles of Bush and the Republicans may not lead to a big political change is there may not be more than 24 House seats in contention. And this, by the way, is a bipartisan desire. Protect your jobs at all costs. Is there an ethical issue to the fact that in covering presidential politics over the last quarter century, over the last quarter century, the average amount of time given to a candidate to speak, in 1968 it was about 48 seconds. By 1996 it was 7.2 seconds. 7.2 seconds. The only thing we have to fear is And more broadly speaking, is there an ethical dimension to the fact that the average network newscast, which a quarter of a century ago was about 23 minutes long when you discounted commercials and promos, now is 18 minutes long, In other words, the equivalent of removing every night one relatively in-depth story from every network newscast. And can we say that a citizen has some ethical questions to answer if he or she chooses, in the face of all that is available, to just be shut off from the world around him and to bond with sitcom and soap opera characters? You know, now, each of these developments, I think, has produced baleful consequences for Walter Capps' national conversation. If you're elected from a safe district, you just never have to engage people with competing views. You never have to leave your protected political bubble. It's no accident, as the Marxists used to say, that the most successful Democrat of our time, Bill Clinton, came from Arkansas, while the most successful Republican politician of our time, Ronald Reagan, came from California. In other words, they had to do more than preach to the choir. They had to learn how to talk to people who were not inclined to agree with them in the first place. And part of the problem, and I think this has been particularly true of the Democratic Party, is that when you choose candidates who are from very safe places, who are used to people nodding in agreement with them to begin with, the art of persuasion tends to get atrophied. So that's part of the problem. Now, a network news broadcast that shaves its time back, and particularly uses what time it has for the news you can use concept, is encouraging viewers to define the world in ever narrower terms. So that's one reason why we woke up about a little more than 4 years ago to find that the whole notion of the end of the Cold War did not mean that we were not facing threats that were quite literally life and death matters, and that a third of the world may hold basic views about women, about liberty, about independence, about heresy. It's completely at odds with ours. And I won't go into the consequences of an ignorant citizenry, since I think the framers spelled that out pretty well. So the question now for me is, which of these things is legitimately considered ethical, and which is the product of these fundamental structural changes? Let me give you a couple of examples. The polarization of our politics. For years, one of the common complaints about our political system in America, unlike others, was that our parties didn't stand for anything. That in the famous words of George Wallace, there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between them. That Republicans could go from Robert Taft to Earl Warren, and Democrats could go from George Wallace to Hubert Humphrey. What we needed, the argument was parties with a more coherent political philosophy. Well, we have gotten a long way toward that point. At root, the Republicans are the conservative party, and the Democrats are the progressive, or as some on the left would say, the less conservative party. And these parties think much more like unified organizations. They work to maximize their advantages where they have them, in part because they have a lot less chance to win where their philosophy doesn't have much appeal. So the consequences for the national conversation, it seems to me, are very serious. In this last presidential campaign, essentially, last two, you could say that the voters in New York, California, Texas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Maryland, Oklahoma, and about 20-something other states never saw a single presidential campaign ad unless they were watching cable. Because the parties knew they couldn't win, or in some cases couldn't lose in those states, they didn't bother. The campaign effectively didn't happen in these places. Now, are these decisions by the campaigns unethical? I think that's absurd. They're the result of core changes in our campaigns. You know, would you have had John Kerry spend 3 days in the Mountain West? Or George Bush and his advisors have sent him up to New England? That's crazy. Another example. Over the years, broadcast networks have drastically cut back convention coverage. What was once wall-to-wall coverage is now about an hour a night, if they cover them at all. One night this year, the three broadcast networks just didn't cover them at all. Why? Because the conventions that in TV's early days were occasions where parties actually chose their candidates and debated their philosophies are now, as often has been said, they're four-day infomercials, designed to present a united front on candidates that were chosen in the primaries. Now, why did this happen? Because in the 1960s, there was a huge complaint that the voters were shut out of the process. These candidates were being chosen by the bosses and hand-picked delegates, and it was time to let the people in. Well, the people now pick these things. Millions of people vote in the primaries. And the parties, having seen the consequence of disputed and contentious conventions, most notably 1968 in Chicago, moved to eliminate every conceivable kind of dissent or protest or spontaneity. So except for the acceptance speeches, the networks have appropriately concluded basically nothing is happening here. And like I say this with deep regret. My childhood ambition, once center field for the New York Yankees and rock guitarist was eliminated, was to be an analyst covering these conventions, which were, in my youth, incredibly exciting. Well, you know, I've achieved that, only to learn that the event that I had yearned to cover has effectively ceased to exist. You know, we can use these conventions to talk a lot about politics for those people who are real junkies, and that's what CNN and the other cable networks do. But it's not a matter that the networks are not covering a consequential process. I got lots of problems with how the broadcast networks cover politics, but this ain't one of them. The parties, for their part, you know, they're not under an obligation to provide a SmackDown event so that our ratings go up. The fact that the length of these campaigns may produce voter exhaustion, which I think does happen. We started polling the 2008 campaign just around the time of Bush's second inaugural. That's not an ethical lapse. There are a lot of things you can say about that, but I don't think that counts. Or even the notion, as Walter Cronkite used to say, that the convention should be covered as civics courses, civics lessons for the public. I was at every minute at these conventions. And I love them. And every so often something happens that is intriguing. Barack Obama's speech was one of those events that you kind of like. John McCain's and Arnold Schwarzenegger's speeches at the Republican convention told me a lot about what was going on in the Bush campaign and what has happened in the Republican Party to make it more appealing to people that never used to vote for it. But I can't claim that the networks have an obligation to cover that wall to wall. And there's a broader point. Because of technology, the news networks that were once impregnable, that once held a monopoly on whether you could see pictures from faraway places, that's gone. You know, if you wanted to see what was happening in the world up till about 25 years ago, you had to watch the network news. There was literally no way for a station anywhere else to get those pictures. And this is because of a broader change. Like every parent, I seek to impart a sense of guilt to my children that I had things much tougher than they did. Well, okay, but I didn't live through the Depression, and, you know, I really wasn't around for World War II. So what do I do? I say, son, you know, when I was your age, we only had black and white television. And the biggest one was only 12 inches big. We only had 7 channels in New York, and you could only watch what was on when it was on. And then I move in for the kill, and I say, and you know, son, when I wanted to change the channel, you know what I had to do? I'm not saying he believes me, but I mean, it's... But the point is, you know, if you wanted to watch television at 7 o'clock in the evening in New York, and you were watching a news program. Because if you weren't watching NBC or CBS, and ABC barely existed, you were watching either a UHF channel that you needed a safecracker's fingers to find, or you were watching some underfunded station that ran Hopalong Cassidy movies. One of the reasons, there's a movie out now about Edward R. Murrow called Good Night and Good Luck, about his confrontation with McCarthy. The show that Edward R. Murrow anchored, See It Now, was a top 10 show in 1953 and 54. Why? Because it wasn't that much else. That's one of the big reasons. Now, the three network share in the news, the three network share in general has dropped from 90% to 50% because you get countless other possibilities. And that monopoly of pictures I talked about was shattered for all time in the mid-70s when the communication satellites began spreading these pictures. It meant that first-run syndicated programs that had a very different definition of news, like Hard Copy, Inside Edition, Access Hollywood, I don't know what the others are called, could compete because they could get from one end of the country to the other without a network. And so the network news operation, they used to call themselves gatekeepers. We'll decide what matters. Well, that's gone. There's no gates anymore. And so whether or not it's the story of a tawdry murder about a pregnant wife or a missing American teenager in the Caribbean, if the networks don't cover it, the cable nets will and the syndicated programs will. Back in the 50s, when Marilyn Monroe divorced Joe DiMaggio, that was screaming front-page news in the New York Daily News. I looked at it. The New York Times, it's sort of somewhere between the shipping ads and the obituaries. And the network news did not exactly cover that story in depth. When Elvis Presley died in 1977, it was a big debate on CBS. How much should we be playing this story? Is this real news? If the equivalent of Elvis Presley died tomorrow, I don't think there'd be much doubt. And maybe that's the right thing. Maybe we were defining news too narrowly. But the point is, because there are more outlets for sensational material, viewers, citizens, have more chance than ever to avoid real news. I mean, it's not that the tastes of the public have gotten less refined. The best-selling magazine in my youth was called Confidential, a monthly, I believe, publication devoting to outing suspected gays and communist sympathizers and revealing the various adulterous habits. That's where I learned that Mickey Mantle played something beside baseball. Broke my heart. But that stuff was not on the major news outlets. Now, that has collapsed. And as for the viewer, as for the citizen, you really want to blame him or her for an attenuated, hazy view of public affairs, considering everything that's thrown at them? One of the great advantages of not having a remote control, from my point of view, is it's a bit of an effort to get up and walk 6 feet across the room and change the channel. You know? Never mind that you thought you'd go blind if you sat too close. So it meant that people actually, if you think about it, people were willing to give you a chance to make a complicated point because, frankly, it was a little bit of a pain, literally, in the rear to get up and change the channel. Now, all of you, more men because, you know, like a lot in life, men tend to graze and women tend to nest. That's a gendered, differentiated remote control thing that at least I have noticed. But the fact is, you have the power at the flick of a finger to wipe us out. Now, what's the consequence of that? It's one of the reasons why everything on television happens more quickly, why they don't think you'll sit still for 48 seconds of a political speech, why they want to get it to you in 7.2 seconds. It's why everything on television is faster, because they're desperate. They're afraid of you. My God, they'll change the channel. So what do? We have lights and we have sounds. Whoosh! That's how we go from one story to another. Watch a commercial, and if you can, count how many different edits there are in it. Watch a promo for a network news TV program, entertainment program. Watch how often the image shifts, because we believe you don't have the attention span to stay with us more than a few seconds at a time. And the reason I mention this in this talk is think what that does for the consequences of an extended national conversation. Even the presidential debates have changed. Some of you look almost old enough to have remembered the first Kennedy-Nixon debates, or you saw them on tape. You know how long the opening statements were in the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debates? 8 minutes. Can you imagine a debate now where the candidates say, let's take 8 minutes, let's just lay this stuff out so people have a sense of what we're about? You have 60 seconds for a response and 30 seconds to answer. What would you do about Iraq? Yeah, I don't need any more. I'll give you some time back. I mean, it's pretty easy. So that's, none of this stuff, in my view, rises to the level of an ethical issue, except insofar as people aren't prepared to try to fight this. It's very disheartening at times to watch people come on television, and because they know how television works, they come out with talking points that they will recite robotically in an interview because they don't trust us to give you to give you an extended version. So, by God, they're going to make those 2 points. If you ask me the question 5 times, I'm going to say it 5 times. You watch the White House briefing lately? I feel so sorry for Scott McClellan. I mean, he looks like Beaker on the old Muppet Show. You know, just beats him up and he says, oh, we're not playing the blame game. Well, what about, not playing the blame game. Where'd you get that shirt? I'm not playing the blame game. I once suggested on the air during impeachment to Larry King that we shouldn't book any guests anymore. We should just have sock puppets. Because they're going to say exactly the same thing, you know? He lied under oath, but he lied about sex. No man's above the law. Can't overturn an election. And that's relentlessly. That's not a healthy national conversation. So, if these developments have affected our public discourse, in my view, more than specifically ethical misbehavior. Because as I would argue, you know, a lazy citizenry, a lazy media, narrowly focused politicians. This is not a creation of our time. These structural changes have led to some of this. Is there a cause for optimism? And here I actually think there is, because I think there are some structural changes going on now that ought to give people hope. Look at the internet. We have forever been worried about the influence of money on politics, how reformers get into power promising to change things, and then as soon as they get, they realize that the money's going to flow to them because they're in power, they want the money. Special interest groups who overwhelm the general interest by pouring cash into a specific initiative. How the little guy is shut out from access. Well, starting with the McCain campaign in 2000, and as Howard Dean showed us last year, the internet turns out to be an incredible fundraising tool, aggregating small amounts of money to add up to huge amounts. John McCain, in the 48 hours, I believe, after he won the New Hampshire primary in 2000, raised $5 million. And Dean, who came out of nowhere, wound up to be the best-funded candidate of the campaign. He had other problems, but money wasn't one of them. The internet's an amazing fundraising tool. There's no the transaction cost is zero. You don't have to print mailers. You don't have to send out postage. The money comes in instantly. It's credited to your account the minute you send in a credit card number. And beside the money, it's an incredible tool for increasing face-to-face communication. And one of the things that I would suggest, I mentioned this at the outset, is that's one of the reasons, there were plenty of others, why in 2004 the voter turnout was the highest percentage it's been since 1968. There were a lot of reasons. Close election, a lot at stake, massive sums of money, evil money poured into getting out the vote. And the reality that people, even if they contribute $10 to a campaign, feel invested in it. And they tend to participate more. And the internet also suggests, it's not a prediction unlike Houston, this also suggests that people genuinely fed up with the two-party system in America, finally have a mechanism to make a potentially independent campaign work. In past times, the only time an independent campaign has worked, I'm not counting Teddy Roosevelt, was either when a candidate had a huge ideological, narrow ideological base, I mean hugely intense, like George Wallace being the last one of that sort, or like Ross Perot could write himself a check for $70 million. There aren't a lot of people around with that capacity. Although when I look at the real estate ads in Santa Barbara magazine, I'm not so sure. But the point is that the net smashes those barriers. And so at least the potential for a kind of invigorated kind of national conversation and even the possibility of a different kind of candidate who literally is not beholden to the normal sources because that candidate can go to people and if his message is powerful enough, $10, $15, $2,500 amounts can add up to tens of millions. That's a real possibility. It's not a prediction for next year, but it's possible. And even though the web has been used by the young mostly for diversion and play, you can at least imagine a situation where a political figure, seeing the structural possibilities out there, begins to talk outside the limits of politics as usual. McCain did some of that in 2000. However, some of you might be disappointed with what he did in the last campaign. He showed that there is this kind of appetite. And in the past, we've never figured out, no candidates figured out how to use it because the party mechanisms and the institutional mechanisms shut them down. To use an example from the other side, you know, a Democratic candidate who wanted to, for instance, challenge monopoly public education, who was ardently for vouchers, let's say, faces the fact that one out of every nine delegates to the Democratic convention is a member of a teachers' union. That's a, you know, I know I don't want to get into the Schwarzenegger what's a special interest thing, but there's a problem there for everybody going outside the canon. Well, the internet may give candidates, unconventional candidates, heretical candidates, a way to create a new kind of constituency. I mean, as far, and maybe even a television network, maybe even mine at some point, might think, you know what, maybe we can figure out a way to build a different kind of an audience. And imagine that, and you don't need a big audience to be a hugely successful cable network. Maybe there are enough people out there who want a different kind of political conversation that we should start to provide it. It's interesting that PBS, the NewsHour, outdraws, except for O'Reilly, I think, all the other cable shows. And at the conventions, PBS outdraws all of them combined, or at least used to. I mean, there's something to the fact that if HBO can make $1 billion a year, more or less, and also program some of the most unconventional, edgy, challenging programming around, maybe the news folks are going to decide, you know, we can both provide a meatier conversation and do very well. We don't know, but at least the technology is out there. So look, we'll never know, unfortunately, whether Walter Capps would have been gratified by what he found in Washington or whether he would have, after one term, said, please, I'm going home. And we won't know whether this whole revolution we're in the middle of, how we talk to each other, how we learn, is going to, in fact, expand or contract this national conversation. But I do think this, if our political leaders and our media and the citizenry act as if this were possible and act as if it were desirable, we would have a whole lot better chance at reconnecting with that conversation, and I think the country would be a whole lot better off for it. Thank you. Okay.
Jeff Greenfield has agreed to take questions, so I'm going to let him field the
yes.
questions directly.
There are mics here. I welcome questions. However, we have to come to a common understanding here of what a question is. Right. If you were watching the confirmation hearings of Justice Roberts, those aren't questions. And just, I need to be honest with you folks, I am ruthless about this. If I hear I have a brief comment first, you know, after the earth cooled, because the more questions, the shorter the questions, the more we get. So with that little item, be my guest, sir.
Thanks for coming. Why does CNN give us the dumbed-down version in America instead of the much better coverage on CNN International?
That was certainly a short question. Next. No, I... There are a couple of answers to this. One is that the audience for CNN International tends to be a much more, if you will, elite audience. Because in a lot of countries, it's played in hotel rooms, in cable networks where cable isn't widespread. The other reason is that having warned about a prolix question, I don't want to get into a prolix answer. But the other reason is CNN International basically covers international events. And there has historically been in America less of an appetite for international events. And I'm talking about going back to the days when George Washington warned about entangling alliances and Thomas Jefferson thought that we should have nothing to do with that corrupt Europe. It's interesting, CNN International was on here for an hour a day until the hurricane wiped it out. But I think the basic reason is it's a different audience. And also, when you are programming for a domestic audience, by definition, particularly an American audience, you are including a lot more material that doesn't get on. I like CNN International. One of the nice things about this revolution I talked about is that with the rise of digital cable, CNN International is now on, you know, my cable system and more and more. We'll have to have another argument or discussion or frank exchange of views about where CNN is dumbed down and where is it. The show I mostly work on, which is Newsnight, I would think is less thumbed down than others. But there are other shows on CNN where I think you're probably right. Yeah.
What's your definition of ethical? You use the term a lot, and I think of it as including some sort of basic training in accountability and responsibility, but you have used the word ethics and ethical as though we all agree about what it is, and What is ethics?
Okay, I was a philosophy major in college.
Good.
Having chosen a vocational major. And I'm not sure that several thousand years have answered that. I was clumsily using it to say behavior that we can hold violated standards of right and wrong. In other words, Jason Blair behaved unethically. Somebody who writes material they know isn't true behaved unethically. If Tom DeLay did what he is accused of, not in Texas, that's a trickier one, But it's tricky. But if Tom DeLay was taking large sums of money from a lobbyist who was hiding the source of it so he could go on expensive golf trips and do him favor, I would say that was probably an ethical problem. And when former Speaker Jim Wright would give a speech that he couldn't get paid for, but he made the audience buy 5,000 copies of his book from which he got royalties, that's unethical. I can do it more concretely. But the point you make that I think is really good, and were this a two-hour, this is a Fidel Castro-length speech, I would have included it, is the refusal to be held, or the lack of accountability. One of the nice things, by the way, in my business is that more and more mainstream news organizations, in part because of the impact of these bloggers who are holding our feet to the fire, are being compelled or realize they've seen the light or felt the heat, I don't know which one, to say, you know what, we're going to tell you when we got things wrong. The New York Times has been going through fits about this. About, they have a piece, I think, just today from their editorial page of how we do this. But I can't answer what generations of philosophers can, but I do know that I was trying to make a distinction between behavior that you could legitimately find egregious or lacking in standards and other forces. That's the best I can do. I'll have to get out my old philosophy books and see what they said. Sir?
Do you see any ethical issues or implications in the following situation? In a recent interview by Diane Sawyer of President Bush, in response to a question by her as to why the government delayed so much in the first hurricane, he said, well, we really didn't know that the levees would break. And she just let that pass and went on to the next question.
Right. Never confuse never confuse a mistake or even denseness with ethical behavior. I mean, I've learned, having committed enough of my own. It's one of the reasons why Tim Russert is as good an interviewer as he is. When he comes in, he researches it like a guy about to do a cross-examination. So he wouldn't even have let that question go. He would have put it, I want to put something up on the screen for you. You said that nobody thought the levees would be breached. Well, here's what, 50 years. So while I suppose at some level, I don't mean this for Diane, sorry, everybody occasionally, not Homer nods, right? Even Homer nods to talk about a philosopher. Here's what I think. I think at the point at which you put people on television where the light in their eyes is coming through the hole in the back of their heads, mentioning no names, then I think the organization can be held to some kind of ethical standard for putting idiots on the air. Yeah, but I don't think, I think that's a big difference between somebody who takes a called strike, I mean, if that's the standard, I bet even people in academia occasionally make mistakes, I mean, I bet lawyers make mistakes. So the reason I'm glad you raised that point is, I really am, is that I think a lot of times we do things like that. The reason why I believe in almost no conspiracy theory, at least the ones that I've heard, is you never confuse screwing up with this plot where these amazingly clever people contrive to do things. I mean, most of the time, it's a mistake. I mean, even to move to a second point, the media have a lot to answer for the coverage of the run-up to the war in Iraq, as, by the way, they do in the run-up to almost every war. I know of no example where, as a country was heading into war, really tough questions were being asked about the consequences. And there's lots of reasons for that. The unethical behavior would be, for instance, knowingly printing something that you had good reason to think was questionable because it backed your point of view. There's another point. I want to take more questions, but I'm going to remember to get back to one other point about this. Yeah.
First, thank you so much for all the great work that you've done over the years, including the time you were at Nightline. I don't know what we would have done without you and some other folks. I wanted to ask you if you could comment on the Judy Miller situation and the fact that of all of the events that we've seen, and it's a smaller issue, obviously there's no press privilege, but the only person who's gone to jail is a reporter who never covered the story.
Right. And I'll tell you something. This is a perfect example of my answer to the last question, because I need to confess something to you that I think a number of my journalistic colleagues will agree with you. I don't know what the hell was going on. I cannot figure this out for the life of me, particularly in the view of what was said after she got out. I'm not being cute here. I don't understand this, because Scooter Libby, Lewis Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, and the lawyer said, we told you a year ago, you're released. She said, well, you know, you had us, the White House asked everybody to sign that waiver. I didn't think it was voluntary. Except three other journalists testified to the grand jury, having gotten more or less the same waiver from the same people who signed the same thing. And the other question that nobody can figure out is, you know, at what point do you pick up the phone and, okay, you don't want to call him because it's pressure. You call his lawyer and you say, John, whatever, my client's about to go to jail. She doesn't think this waiver that Scooter Libby gave her is real. Is it real? I mean, what do you want us to do here? Because he, you know, Mr. Libby, is absolutely adamant that he wants all these reporters to testify because he thinks they'll help him. I can't figure that one out. The broader question of a privilege, which I had an interesting conversation with a bunch of people at a forum last week, it seems to me that yes, there ought to be some kind of federal law that protects a reporter under most circumstances. The problem is you can't do a law, you can't have an absolute privilege, apart from the obvious reasons, I know where a terrorist is hiding, I'm not going to tell you. But there's other reasons. You know, people leak to us for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes they're courageous whistleblowers, and sometimes they have an agenda. They hope if they leak us a story, it'll shoot it down. And sometimes they're out to get another guy. I want to give this one example that I had no real knowledge of. You know the case of Wenho Li? He's the Taiwanese-born. He was a nuclear scientist. He was accused of committing the worst espionage since Aldrich Ames and the Rosenbergs. Jailed, lost his job, and then it turned out the whole thing was of whole cloth. Now, there were specific government agents who leaked these stories to the press. His lawyer is now suing the government for an invasion of privacy. The only way he can know who did this to him was for the press to tell him. Well, the press is saying, we're not going to tell you, and they're being held in civil contempt. Okay. Now, is that a clear-cut First Amendment case where people like me should go to the barricades and say, John Peter Zenger, Thomas Jefferson, you know, these are the freedoms for which I didn't serve in the Army? Or is there a problem where if you don't find out who is, this guy whose life was ruined by, you know, deliberate spreading of defamatory information has no justice? Very complicated. But to go back to your first question, I can't wait to find out what the heck this is about. I for the life of me.
My question is related to the last question, but it deals with the ethical dimensions of the press corps shibboleth of never revealing your sources without permission. Do you make an ethical distinction between a Woodward and Bernstein who are protecting a source that's exposing criminality versus the Karl Rove, Judith Miller one, where a high government source is using the press as an agenda to attack a political critic? And right. Does that deserve protection?
Well, I want to give you a more clear-cut example where the press clearly outed somebody. It was Scooter Libby, I think, and Judith Miller, wasn't it? And Karl Rove and Matt Cooper.
Yes.
Okay. There's a problem here because, as I said, people leak for a lot of reasons. And the question here is actually another, I don't know why I'm talking about philosophy. There's an old law school professor of mine who teaches philosophy who was raising this question, saying the privilege is really not a matter of principle, it's a policy. We think the press should have some protection because we think in general it'll increase the free flow of information. And you have to be careful about assessing the motives in most cases. You can't just say, well, the guy really was out to screw somebody, so I'll reveal. I mean, because for one thing, on a pragmatic ground, the next person you call is going to say no. But here's an example that I do remember. When Jim Wright left the speakership in 89 and Tom Foley took it over, some Republican aide began to spread the story that Tom Foley's sexuality was a question. And this was so disgusting that the press explained who did it, and the guy lost his job. So there is some level at which you don't... Now, I don't even know if this guy was promised confidentiality. It's a different kind of case. But I think you'd have no hesitation maybe. And that's why, you know, to me, the Wenho Lee case is so dramatic, because it's not even a case of an agenda. It's government agents going around spreading what was apparently completely false information, destroying a man's life. So at some point, I accept the point that you have to make distinctions, but you can't just do it by saying, well, this was a good guy, and I'm not sure why this happened, and because you wind up then never getting confidential sources, and there are reasons to have them. One thing I've noticed is a lot of the press is now telling readers why they've kept the person quiet, or why the person didn't want to be. I mean, they're saying one senior White House official who insisted on anonymity because he was told he'd be fired if he talked about this told us. Or more seriously, I mean, I've seen that. Or, you know, one person who insisted on anonymity because he has close relationships with the, you know, whoever. So they're at least giving you a reason. I've even seen cases where the press has said one person who insisted on anonymity because he's deeply opposed to the policy under consideration. That's a good reason to, you know, you're not leaking, but you're telling the viewer or the reader something significant. You know, this is not an easy one. This whole area is really easy.
Yeah. I'm a great admirer of you, and I feel that if you're not enough on CNN to give the reporting. I'm a Holocaust survivor, and it pains me greatly that the press has completely ignored Darfur and the Sudan. So little is there. When I was in New York recently, what did I see on the New York Times? Runaway bride and some sensational other things. And where is that ethical dilemma about reporting?
You're at a really significant point with that question. The first thing to say is that, you know, the New York Times is the most, it's not the most widely read paper in America, but it's obviously the most influential. One of their key columnists, Nick Kristof, has written over and over and over again about Darfur. So we can't really say, I think, that it's a matter of, and I know that CNN has done, maybe not the day you saw it, but we've done reporting on it. But here, you know, here again the dynamic gets much more complicated, I think, than just, okay, what's the ethical problem? It relates to the question, the very first question about international news. I'm going to take a minute here. This country was born in revolt against Europe. It had a lengthy tradition that because we were protected by two oceans, because we were different, we were not going to get involved with the rest of the world. This was a conscious, now it was never fully true. And starting with Teddy Roosevelt and the Great White Navy, you know, we began to flex our muscles. But I'm smiling because I'm remembering a story that when World War I broke out, the Denver Post didn't cover it. And somebody asked the publisher or editor, why didn't you cover World War I? And he said, referring to the Main Street or a Main Street in Denver, he said, you know, a dogfight on Champa Street is of more interest to my readers than some silly quarrel in Europe. It really wasn't until the rise of Hitler that and the rise of CBS News and Edward R. Murrow that we began to connect to the world. And I would remind you that as late as 1941, 3 months before Pearl Harbor, the vote on the extension of the draft passed the House of Representatives by one vote. And there was a tremendously powerful isolationist movement in this country, which periodically crops up. When the Cold War ended, the Republican Party, which had been robustly international, I am actually getting to this question, people like Dick Armey and DeLay moved to a much more isolationist position. They were not at all keen on Clinton going into the Balkans. And it took Clinton long enough to get into the Balkans, and he never went into Rwanda. This history, which is still embedded, even after 9/11, I think, in our minds, that we are protected. We're far away from the rest of the world. The people in Darfur, like the people in Rwanda, don't look like many Americans. You know, it's not as if this were happening in Ireland or Israel. Even the Balkans were European, seemed distant. We have a very difficult problem in the United States connecting. And the last part about this is, in terms of television, Darfur is very hard to get to. It's not that you can just take a camera and throw up a picture, even in a satellite age. That's another one of the logistical issues. One of the reasons I always thought why we never understood the full nature of what was going on in a lot of the Arab world was, you know, when Assad or Saddam Hussein decides to wipe out several thousand people in his own country, there are no pictures of that. You add all of that together, and it takes a tremendous effort to get people's attention focused on it. And because there are so many other different stories, I sometimes regard it like a spotlight, a moving spotlight at a premiere. You know, it illuminates something for a minute, but it doesn't stay there. But there are people, and Christoph is one of them to his credit. I'll tell you who else, by the way. I'm not sure how many in this audience will necessarily credit this. Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, who has said some very provocative and not entirely helpful things about the Muslim world. Because the persecution in Sudan involves also Christians, he was a big influence in trying to get the president at least to acknowledge that this is genocide. Not that much has happened on that. One last point. If you want to read, this is information. If you want to read the best explanation of why Americans don't respond in this area, read Samantha Power's book called A Problem from Hell, won the Pulitzer Prize. She's a brilliant 34-year-old Harvard professor who covered the war in the Balkans. And she traces the history of American non-response from the genocide in Turkey right through the Holocaust in Cambodia right up to the Balkans. And it will tell you how complicated and how difficult this is to get not just the press, but American presidents to care. So, sorry, but I didn't want to give you a 7.2-second answer.
Thank you, Jeff. Your being here and inaugurating the Ethics Forum for the CAF Center, I think the way you've brought the subject to us is an indication of what is going to happen that will answer Walter's concern of why he went to Washington. And I want to thank Judith Mizell for asking you about Darfur and the Sudan. And my question has to do with why you said there are a lot of things that didn't go right about your profession in the run-up to the war, but that always happens with war. And that makes me think about what she asked you and also about the first question about international CNN International. But I also want to, because I think a lot happened after 9/11, and I want to credit CNN with bringing this nation together around the people of the Gulf states affected by Katrina, particularly Katrina, which I think the persistence of CNN, without it, the ethical questions would not have been asked. And there are more ethical questions to be asked.
Thank you, Lois. But consider, it's not often that a journalist wants to amend a compliment. But, you know, if you're gonna be straight about it, you got to be straight. Look, there are a couple of things about this. First of all, I think because the reporters were there, unlike Darfur, they were able to see the gap between official pronouncements and the reality. In fact, the first person who I saw do this was Anderson Cooper, when Mary Landrieu. Got up, and first thing she said was, I want to compliment President Bush, and I want to compliment the government. Anderson, who was working on about 2 hours sleep the last 3 weeks, said, excuse me, I guess I didn't see that because I've just been seeing dead people, and, you know, I really wish you wouldn't do that. But it's because of that presence. One of the responses that was really very different 20 years ago than Darfur was the response to the starvation in Ethiopia. Why? Because a BBC camera crew happened to be at a feeding station and caught these incredible pictures of children being turned, literally starving children being turned away. That led to Live Aid. The head of AID told me years later it probably saved a few million lives. So the presence is a big difference. But the other thing is, look what happened in the reporting of Katrina. I mean, one of the things that happened was, because there was no communication, the local officials and some in the press, many in the press, spread stories that were absolutely wrong. The rapes of babies, the, you know, people eating, resorting to cats, these things, as far as anybody can tell, never happened. And what interested me about that was, as these stories developed, everybody used them to make points about their own political views. That is, for A lot of people on the left disproved that the government was officially indifferent to the plight of poor people and black people, and people on the right said, you see, it's the breakdown in that community. Those people, they just, you know, single parenthood or whatever, they don't live like normal human beings. Now, is that an ethical problem? I mean, the mayor of New Orleans tells you these things are happening. You're a reporter. You rely on him. How do you check this? Very tricky stuff. And that's why they call journalism the first rough draft of history.
But I salute you for continuing the network, your station, for continuing on with that story, and would hope that there are other issues as important to our nation and to the world that beg for continued investigation.
One can only hope. Lois.
You didn't incorporate any discussion of the consolidation of media ownership, and I'm curious as to why you didn't include that in your speech, what you think the impact has been both now and into the future.
It's a valid question, and once again, I consider it an act of mercy in part. I just don't know how much we can go, but here's what I think about this. One of the problems we've been facing, all the networks, is that we have become smaller and smaller entities in larger and larger corporate enterprises. When ABC News was a part of ABC, and even when it was part of Capital Cities, which is essentially a broadcast company, we were a pretty big deal. Because I then worked for ABC News. ABC News is now a part of the Disney Company, a small, struggling, I don't know, $18 gazillion a year enterprise, and it gets less attention. The other thing about it is because all three networks are now part. And this happened over the last 20 years. All three networks are now part of much bigger enterprises. ABC is Disney, NBC is General Electric, and CBS is Viacom, and CNN is Time Warner, and Fox is News Corp, Murdoch's operation, MSNBC is GE. But here's the other part about this. And this, to some extent, this gets back to that pastoral, that things are always better in the old days. When you go see the Murrow movie, and you see Bill Paley, now he was the boss. It was just CBS. There was no mega corporation. And watch, it's all based on what he did. Watch the behavior of Bill Paley, who kind of had to step back and let Murrow and Ed Friendly do the thing with McCarthy, but hated it. And a few years later, took See It Now off the air because he said, "Well, that time is too valuable, and I'm tired of getting a stomachache every." It's a true. I'm tired of getting a stomachache every time you guys put something on that bothers our affiliates. My point about this is that even in the dear old days, before media consolidation, there was plenty of room for the clash between, you know, corporate and journalistic interests. I also tell you that. In a lot of small towns with one, or medium-sized towns, or not so medium-sized towns, with one newspaper, there's plenty of room for that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a perennial story. A reporter goes out and does a story on where you can buy the best, you know, how to beat the car dealers on buying a car. Well, automobile dealers tend to be a big advertiser in local newspapers. They don't like that. Real estate, now how do you save money on your real estate commissions? Not a big favorite among real estate folks. And one of the advantages about consolidation, 60 Minutes was a demonstration of this, is they did a piece on, years ago on, what the heck was the, they did a piece on a particularly unsafe automobile. I think it was a Ford, but I don't hold me to that. And the Ford said, we're not going to advertise on you anymore. And they said, fine, we got 50 guys lined up, you know. So it's sometimes size can actually protect you from corporate interference. So what I most worry about, the most obvious thing to worry about is, you're ABC or any of the others, you're going to do a piece about corruption in the Chinese government as they, you know, they're doing all kinds of deals that they shouldn't be doing. Meanwhile, your parent company is trying to get a cable franchise in China. This has happened, and it causes problems. And I don't have a ready answer to that. But you're right. It definitely belongs in the conversation. I just don't think you should assume that without media consolidation, there's no chance for journalistic corruption. Upton Sinclair wrote a book called The Brass Check somewhere in the 20s about this, and he didn't have a whole lot of complimentary things to say about the people who own the newspapers. I'm sorry.
Are you so afraid of freedom of speech that you feel you have to control even this forum? I mean, isn't it bad enough that CNN hardly ever puts a peace activist or a real critic of our corrupt political system on the airwaves? I mean, aren't the politicians, these 90% that keep getting reelected, corrupted by the money that's contributed to them? And you know, and what about, why does all this money for all these political ads that people raise, that the feeble attempts to try to influence this plutocratic system, and that, where does that money go? It goes to your networks, the few corporations you're talking about. Shouldn't these corporations that use the public airways be in a democratic state, if it was really democratic, offer free time to all the candidates? Like you say, it's a few seconds. It's pitiful. And we're in a country that has become a criminal regime because of an illegal war. Okay, and now, anyone who pays taxes to this government, is half of those income taxes are going for military spending, and those are crimes.
Thank you. Here's the answer to your question. And you could have actually saved yourself a lot of trouble by doing a little research. 30 years ago, I co-wrote a book where I specifically argued for free time for federal candidates for office. I think it's a very good idea. So, you know, that you could have found that out. It was published by a real
publisher. Expect me to be an expert on you?
No.
I have other things to study.
I'm just saying that I happen to think that that's a good idea. The problem with it is you have to start figuring out who qualifies and under what circumstances. Now, I'm going to answer this question because you asked it, okay? You can't give free time to everybody on a ballot. There are too many people in too many offices. So the first thing you have to decide, I think, is that since you could do this with an FCC rule, you'd have to do it for candidates for federal office. And you'd have to pass a certain bar. What I suggested was you needed to demonstrate some level of support so that crackpots who get on the ballot in states where it's easy don't qualify. I mean, 5% of the people in the district sign a petition. There are ways to do that. So there are logistical problems, but I think the general answer is it's a good idea. The second thing is, the reason why I didn't want speeches here was because I'm such a devotee of free speech, I wanted more people to have a chance to ask questions. If people give five-minute speeches, that restricts. The same point you're making about, you know, people who buy up a lot of time.
And I waited till there was no one else to speak.
But that's why. It was a simple effort to try to get more of a dialogue going. And by the way, congratulations. This is the most... I think you should all do the inquiry on the next Supreme Court justice, because we actually might learn something.
Let's thank Jeff Greenfield.
The last point I want to make is I think the idea that CNN or other networks don't put on, you know, I have seen Cindy Sheehan more than a few times. I think she's getting her own show. The idea that she's not been given a chance to speak is frankly ludicrous. And it's, you know what? It seems to have had some kind of an impact. I also would point out, just in closing, that for all of the fact that we don't have the kind of national conversation I would want to see, there is some sense, I don't know how it happens, that people actually do respond to events, that it is not strictly in the control of the people in power. I mean, if you think that the Bush administration is happy with the way the public now regards the war in Iraq, Now, the really tough question, and I wish I had the answer to Lois Kapp's question, is I wish I could figure out why in every run-up to every war, and not just in the United States, it may have something to do with rooting for the home team. It may have something to do with when...
Because you don't put the critics on the air. This made a script.
Okay.
No.
As a matter of fact, we have put plenty of critics on the war on the air. I'm trying to explain to you why, actually trying to make a point that you might actually approve of if you would perhaps listen. It's all right. Just try listening. It's two-way, okay? The reason why the media tend to follow policymakers and believe what they say about an impending military conflict is something that has been with us forever. There's a book called The First Casualty. You might want to check it out by Phil Knightley, which goes back to, the Crimean War and how the press behaves under these circumstances. I just want to make this one more point and we'll stop. When the war was just before the war began, some trade publication interviewed the president of CBS News and asked him, are you going to be neutral? And he said, what, are you crazy? I'm an American citizen. I want America to win. This is my country. Now, is that what a press organization should be doing? And is that one of the reasons why credence is given to people who later turn out to be wrong? I mean, I still don't know why, I suppose go back and look. How much were Colin Powell's assertions, I actually do know because there's a very smart piece written about this in the New York Review of Books. The critics got press attention, but the critics were on the inside pages of the newspaper and the policymakers were on page one. And that's what tends to happen. Now, you know, as to the rest of the gentleman's questions, you get to decide for yourself. All I'm telling you is that some of these things have much more to do with, I think, instincts for how people behave in a crisis, what people want to believe. And, you know, I was around for the Vietnam War. We went through the same damn thing, you know, with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So, with that, thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.